Part 6 Chapter 1
Ernst, I must speak with you a moment, says my father.
I can guess what is coming. For days he has been going about with an anxious air, dropping hints, but I have always escaped him until now, for I am not often at home. We go to my room. He sits down on the sofa and looks uncomfortable.
We are worried about your future, Ernst.
I produce a box of cigars from the bookcase and offer them to him. His face brightens a little. They're good cigars. I had them from Carl, and Carl smokes no beech leaf.
Have you really given up your position as a teacher?
He asks. I nod.
And why did you do that, may I ask?
I shrug my shoulders. How should I even begin to explain it to him? We are two utterly different men and have got along well together thus far only because we have not understood each other at all.
And what do you propose doing now?
He goes on. Oh, anything, I say. It's all one to me. He looks at me shocked and begins to talk about a good and respected calling, about getting on and making a place in life for myself. I listen to him sympathetically, but am bored. How strange that this man on the sofa here should be the father who formerly regulated my life. Yet he was not able to look after me in the years out there. He could not even have helped me in the barracks. Any NCO there carried more weight than he. I had to get through as best as I could by myself, and it was a matter of entire indifference whether he existed or not. When he had finished, I pour him out a glass of cognac. Now listen, father, I say, and sit down over against him. You may be right in what you say, but you see, I have learned how to live in a hole in the ground on a crust of bread and a little drop of thin soup. And so long as there was no shelling, I was quite content. An old hut seemed to me to be positive luxury, and a straw mattress in the rest area was paradise. So you see, the mere fact that I am still alive and there is no shelling, that is enough for me for the moment. What little I need to eat and drink I can rake together all right. For the rest, there is my whole life before me.
Yes, he objects. But that is no life, a bare hand-to-mouth existence like that.
Every man to his taste, I say. To me, it would seem no life to be able to say at the finish that I had entered every day for 30 years the same schoolroom or the same office. Rather astonished, he replies,
It's 20 years now that I have been going to the carton factory, yet I have always contrived to be my own master.
I don't want to contrive to be anything, father. All I want is to live.
And I have lived, and uprightly, and respectably, too, he says with an accession of pride. It wasn't for nothing I was elected to the Chamber of Commerce.
Then be thankful that you have had it so easy, I retort.
But you must do something, you know, he complains.
I can get a job for the present with one of my army pals. As a matter of fact, he has already offered me one, I say. That will bring in all I need. He shakes his head.
And for that you would give up a good civil service job.
I have often had to give up things before now, father. He puffs away at his cigar distressfully.
And even a short of a pension, too.
I say, laughing. Where's the soldier who will live to see 60? There are things in our bones that will only show themselves later. We'll all have packed up before then, don't you worry. With the best will in the world, I cannot believe I shall reach 60. I have seen too many men die at 20. I smoke away thoughtfully and look at my father. I still see that this is my father, but also I can see he is just a kindly, somewhat older man, rather cautious and pedantic, whose views have no longer any meaning for me. I can quite well picture what he would have been at the front. Somebody would always have had to be looking after him one way or another, and he would certainly never have become an NCO. I go to see Ludwig. He is sitting amid a pile of pamphlets and books. I should like to talk with him about many things that are troubling me. I have a feeling that he might perhaps be able to show me a way. But he himself is disturbed and agitated today. We talk a while aimlessly of this and of that. Then at last he says, "I must go to the doctor now." "The dysentery still?" I ask.
"No, something else."
"Why, what's the matter now, Ludwig?" I ask in surprise. He is silent a while. His lips quiver. Then he says, "I don't know." "Like me to come with you? I haven't anything particular to do." He hunts for his cap.
"Yes, do come."
As we walk, he takes occasional stealthy sidelong looks at me. We turn down Linden Street and go in at a house that has a small, cheerless front garden with a few miserable shrubs in it. I read the white enamel plate on the door. "Dr. Friedrich Schultz, specialist in skin, urinary, and sexual diseases." I stand still.
"What's up then, Ludwig?"
He turns a pale face toward me.
"Nothing much, Ernst. I had a sort of a boil out there once, and it's come back again now."
"Oh, why, if that's all it is, Ludwig," I say, relieved. "You should have seen some of the carbuncles I've had. As big as a baby's head, some of them. Comes from all this substitute food muck we've had." We ring the bell. A sister in a white overall opens to us. We are both terribly embarrassed, and with faces like beetroots, go into the waiting room. There, God be thanked, we are alone. On the table is a litter of numbers of the magazine Die Woche. We turn the pages. They are rather ancient. They have only just reached the piece of Brest-Litovsk here. The doctor comes in, spectacles flashing. The door into the consulting room stands half open behind him, and one can see a chair there made of nickel piping and leather, dreadfully practical and painful looking. It's queer that so many doctors should have a preference for treating their patients as if they were children. With dentists, of course, it is part of the regular training. It would appear to be so with this sort here, too.
"Well, Mr. Breyer,"
says the bespectacled cobra playfully.
"So we are to become a little better acquainted shortly?"
Ludwig stands there like a ghost and swallows hard.
"Is it?"
The doctor nods encouragingly.
"Yes, the blood test is back. Positive. Now we must really begin to talk to the old rascal severely."
"Positive," stammers Ludwig.
"Then that means..."
"Yes," answers the doctor. "We must make a little cure."
"Then that means I've got syphilis."
"Yes."
A blowfly buzzes through the room and bumps against the window. Time has stopped. The soggy air sticks fast between the walls. The world has changed. An awful fear has turned to an awful certainty.
"Can there not be a mistake?" asks Ludwig. "Couldn't they make a second blood test?"
The doctor shakes his head.
"It is better we should start the cure soon. The stage is secondary."
Ludwig gulps.
"Is it curable?"
The doctor becomes animated. His face is almost jovial with reassurance.
"Absolutely. These little tubes here, all we do is to inject them over a period of, let us say, 6 months to begin with. Then we shall see. Perhaps hardly anything more will be necessary. Oh, yes, syphilis is quite curable these days."
Syphilis. Revolting word. Sounds as if it were a thin black snake.
"Did you get it out at the front?"
asks the doctor. Ludwig nods.
"Why didn't you have it treated at once?"
I didn't know what it was. No one ever told us about these things before, and it only showed itself a long time after and seemed harmless enough. Then it went away again of itself. The doctor shakes his head.
Yes, that is the reverse side of the medal, he says glibly.
I would like to bash him one over the head with a chair. A lot he knows what it means to get 3 days' leave to Brussels, to come by the night train straight from shell holes and slush and filth and blood into a city with streets, lamps, lights, shops, and women, where there are fine hotel rooms and white bathtubs, and a man can soak himself and scour off all the dirt, where is soft music and terraces and cool, rich wine. A lot he knows of the enchantment that is in the blue, misty twilight of such a little moment between horror and horror. A rift in the clouds, it is. A wild outcry of life in the brief interval between death and death. Who knows but that in a few days he may be hanging on the barbed wire, with torn limbs, bellowing, thirsting, perishing. Yet one more swig of this heavy wine, yet one more breath, one glimpse more into this insubstantial world of moving color, dreams, women, inflaming whispers, words, under whose spell the blood becomes like a black fountain, under whose touch the years of filth and madness and hopelessness resolve and change to sweet, singing eddies of memory and hope. Tomorrow death will rush in again with his guns, hand grenades, flamethrowers, blood and annihilation. But today, this soft skin, fragrant and calling as life itself, what intoxicating shadows upon the shoulders, what soft arms. It crackles and flashes and bursts and pours down. The sky burns. Who will think then that in such whispering charm, in such fragrance, such skin, that other thing, syphilis, may be in ambush, watching, hidden, crouching, waiting? Who knows and who wants to know? Who thinks then of anything but today? Tomorrow? Why, tomorrow it may all be over. Bloody war that taught us to recognize only the moment and to have it. And now? Asks Ludwig. Let us begin as soon as we can. At once, then, says Ludwig quietly. He goes with the doctor to the consulting room. I remain in the waiting room, where I occupy myself tearing up a few numbers of Die Woche, in which is figured nothing but parades and victories and pithy sayings of war-intoxicated clergymen. Ludwig comes back. Go and see another doctor, Ludwig, I whisper to him. I'm sure this fellow doesn't know his job. He hasn't any brain. Ludwig makes a tired gesture, and we go down the stairs in silence. At the bottom, with averted face, he says suddenly, Well, goodbye. I look up. He is leaning against the railing, and his fists are clenched in his pockets. What's wrong? I ask, rather startled. I am going now, he answers. Well, give us your paw, can't you? I say, mystified. With trembling lips, he protests. But you mustn't touch me now. Now I'm... Shy and slim, there he stands by the railing, just as he would lean against the parados, with sad face and lowered eyes. Ah! Ludwig, Ludwig, what rot will you say next? Not touch you, you old fathead, you silly ass. Touch you? There, I touch you. 100 times I touch you. It has so hurt me, blast it. Now I am blubbering, damned fool. And I put my arm about his shoulder and press him to me, and I feel how he is trembling. Ah, Ludwig, that's all bunk. And anyway, I may have it myself for all I know. You just keep calm now, and that goggle-eyed old snake up there will soon put you right again. But he trembles and trembles, and I hold him fast.